Today on Marketing Mavericks, we talk with Jeff Jarvis, Scott Monty, and Brian Rich, all about the leaked New York Times Innovation Report. What does that mean for media and journalists? Coming up next.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
Bandwidth for Marketing Mavericks is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
Welcome to Marketing Mavericks, where we talk about everything in the intersection of marketing and technology. Today, we're going to talk about creating content. We're going to talk about traditional media and journalism, as well as the agency side and how agencies have become media providers. They're trying to replace, I think, traditional media and become their own media agencies. We've got a couple of really great guests in this category. We've got Jeff Jarvis, who is the author of Buzz Machine. He is a techno journalist and teaches technology at the University of New York. And we've also got Brian Rich, who's the managing director at Little M Media. And I should say, too, Jeff, you're also a co-host of one of our Twit shows, which is
Twig, This Week in Google.
Very cool
and
show.
Just so my dean doesn't get mad at me, it's the City University of New York, where I'm the Graduate School of Journalism. Just so we make sure that I get and Brian is a proud alum of our entrepreneurial program. Or maybe not proud. I hope he's proud.
No, I'm very proud.
You should be proud.
I came out the other side much better than when I went in.
That explains
extruded
a lot.
Like a sausage, yes.
It explains a lot. I have a lot of respect for Brian. So that he was under your tutelage makes complete sense to me.
I went through. She just, you know, barely gave me any attention at all. And then I went through your program, Jeff, and now it's been all uphill for me.
Fame and fortune follow. I know, Brian. Yes.
So I've been a fan of both of yours for a long time. So, you know, there's been a lot of conversation last week. Certainly, I've been following you, Jeff, for a long time, talking about journalism and how it needs to change and how media, you know, news, everything from traditional print to all types of media outlets need to change. This week, the New York Times had an innovation report that was leaked, and it's been a big topic of conversation for people not only in journalism, but on the digital agency side as well. And I thought, who more perfect to talk about this than you? So let's start with the New York Times and this manifesto. You read it.
Quickly. I went through very quickly because I had a little time before the show, but I did pass my eyes over the whole thing.
You had the Cliff Notes, which I think is embarrassing to say. I know what Cliff Notes are, but you had the Cliff Notes. And I guess my first question would be, is it too late? I mean, they're kind of realizing, you know, some things they got correct in this, I think, that they need to do. But what was your first blush? What was your first thought?
We love the New York Times. The New York Times is an amazing institution. It's an important institution. It matters to the country. It's the best newspaper we have, apart from The Guardian, where I also work and I'm partial. But it's a phenomenal thing. And, you know, I'm not sure why it has to be such a difficult place. The Guardian this week has been going through, the Times, rather, has been going through considerable roilings, and The Guardian has been on the ascendance. Of course, Jill Abramson, the executive editor, was fired, not very ceremoniously. Dean Baquet took over the job. There's been much controversy around that, around her management style, allegedly, and also her compensation and other things. And then part of the fight with the Times was they tried to hire Janine Gibson, the editor-in-chief of Guardian US. She said no, she's going to London. So they didn't get Janine, and then Janine went and hired away Aaron Pilhofer, who is the digital genius at the New York Times, to become executive editor of The Guardian over digital there. So they lost again. And then in the meantime, out comes this report, which basically says we're behind. And there are decent ideas in the report, but I don't think anything in it at all is new. I don't think anything we haven't heard elsewhere. I also consult for Digital First Media, headed by John Payton, who really coined this notion of being digital first. So there's a lot that the Times should do, indeed. Is it too late? I certainly hope not. But I also think they've got to get off their asses and move even faster. And the Times, mind you, is one of the most innovative news organizations we have. I was with some big investors in California just last week, and they were talking about one of these papers. I won't say which one. And one of these papers is brilliant and far ahead. But they were kind of saying, if that's the best the newspaper industry has to offer, uh-oh. And that's the Silicon Valley attitude toward my industry. And so we're seeing innovation elsewhere, but it's not necessarily the highest quality innovation. I don't think that BuzzFeed and Upworthy are the highest quality things on life, nor the Huffington Post, though they have their place in life. The New York Times matters, but it's got to accelerate its innovation.
Do you think it's a little late for them? I mean, we've been talking about this for years, and you say this is a great publication. I would agree with you, except that they're just now kind of coming to this place of realization of the things that they need to do. And I don't think everything that they said in this manifesto is right. I don't think that all of the things that they need to do are, and they come in a, let's say this, they come in a really great position of having great content. And a part of this innovation report basically stated that they should create kind of evergreen content, which is an industry term for something really relevant and, you know, just, you know, trending, if you will. But they have, what, over 300 URLs and over 14 million articles that date back to 1851. Lots of great content, really, really good journalism. Why would they, do you think they should try to create kind of BuzzFeed kind of comment, you know, happy puppy pictures or things
God
to give people?
God help us, no. No, wash your mouth out. perish the thought. No, no, they certainly shouldn't. But they have to rethink what they do. You know, my greatest heresy these days is to argue that we in journalism should not think of ourselves as being in the content business. We are a service. We are a service to communities that make communities smarter and help them know what they need to know to do what they want to do. And you judge our success then not by the old mass media metrics of reach and frequency, page views, and unique users. Instead, you have to start to judge our success on whether or not we help communities do what the communities want to do, which means we have to start by listening to the communities. We have just decided at CUNY to go after starting a new degree in what we're calling social journalism, the study and practice of engagement in engaged communities. Well, that practice has to start with listening to the public, listening to what the public wants, instead of starting with our content. But the Times report, like the entire industry, I'm not singling out the Times here, but the Times report is really a good indication of how we think. We think it's all about this product we make called content. And a lot of the report is about, you know, how do we get more attention for our stuff? Enough about you. What do you think about us? And all of our metrics are about looking at our stuff. And it's just too damned egocentric, I think.
You know, I would agree. And I think Times is a great publication. Let's go back to something you said earlier, which was, I think the first trending big topic, and mostly it was within the journalism community. Journalists were really upset over the firing of Jill Abramson, who today actually spoke about the situation in a presentation that she was giving. What it was a public appearance, and I'm reading here her comments. It's an 11-minute speech, and she came out about kind of her struggle, and she wanted people to come out to her about their being fired and that sort of thing, which I think is really honest and genuine. Do you think that this was a strategic? I mean, most people said it was because she wasn't paid equally, and that was the big reason why she was let go. Do you think that that was a part of this whole?
No, that's one reported part of this. And there's been various reporting about pay, and it's hard to calculate because there's stock options and all kinds of things and pensions involved. But no, Arthur Sulzberger came out straight out and said that he had an issue with her management style and practices. And she was seen, one word was used about her, as pushy. Well, that's a pretty darned sexually gender-loaded word, isn't it? Kara Swisher wrote, I think, a really brilliant post about this, from one pushy editor to another pushy editor. And, you know, it's number one, prior editors of the Times, male, have been pushy and obnoxious and difficult as hell and didn't get fired over it. Most of them didn't. And number two, it's harder for a woman to be in this position. And, you know, I think if you look at someone like Marissa Meyer, who, you know, gets crap for being cold or steely or other words about her. Well, what do you expect her to be in the position that she's in? She has to be. She's a tough manager in a tough position. And it's not time for hugs and kisses. Same with the New York Times, for God's sakes. Earlier editors of the Times were just known to be absolutely a-holes, but they were good at what they did, and they put that a-holishness to good end. And so Jill Abramson, yeah, she was difficult. Her tone of voice, if you ever listen to Jill, she didn't really ever sound too happy because it's a new, you know, a heck of a New York accent. Sounds a bit Eeyore-ish, but she's a brilliant editor. And she was the first woman editor of the New York Times and was brusquely shoved aside. And that alone is a troubling thing.
So who do they need? Who's going to make this innovation for the New York Times work? I mean, I agree. And I think pushy can, especially being a female in business, can tend to be a word that we, you know, don't like because, it, you know, you wouldn't approach a man the same way. I get that. So who do they need? Do they need another woman? Do they need, what kind of personality is going to help implement some of the things in this innovation report?
Well, Janine Gibson from The Guardian would have been brilliant in the role, but I'm glad The Guardian still has her. Aaron Pilfhoffer was brilliant in the role. It's too bad they lost him. They had this newsroom innovation report was written by a bunch of the young, bright people in the newsroom, and they better work very, very hard to hold on to those people and to listen to what they say. You know, I tell my students that when I came into the business, this is a, you know, Uncle Jeff moment here. When I came into the business, youth was something you had to get over. You had to grow out of youth and the limitations of it. Now youth is an asset, right? Young people have, it's not that they're digital natives. There is no such thing, as Dana Boyd tells us. But young people do at least have a different worldview when it comes to media and what we do. And we have to respect that and have to listen to it. Clay Shirky says that he makes a good analyst but a bad entrepreneur because he was taught when he grew up that you go to a store to try on pants and you go to a record store to buy music and you go get to a newspaper to get the news. And he had to unlearn all those things. And that allows him to explain the transition from one to another. But he constantly still thinks, he admits, in the old way. And I'm certainly of that age too. So I think that youth is an important asset to bring into the Times. And whether it's the Times or other news organizations, I think there has to be a skip of generations. I think that people my age have to be skipped over by people a full generation younger than us, and we have to give them the faith to see that they can bring these institutions into a new age.
So what would you say then about this report as it relates to creating, you said, you know, perish the thought, and we're getting a lot of questions right now, of course, in the chat room about this idea of, you know, what's more valuable, and I can't see all of them, but just kind of what's the idea between the value of the content they're creating versus how you get more people to your website, which I think is what they're really trying to do. They're trying to drive traffic, and they're trying to figure out the best way to do that. So what should they be thinking about?
Well, I think they have to think about different metrics about built around relationships. I think we have to think about building true and deep, meaningful and trustworthy relationships with people, rather than seeing people as a mass. The truth is we still see people as a mass all the same. And that was the business model upon which mass media was built, right? The great myth of mass media, poor Brian has heard me say this in class. The great myth of mass media is that all readers see all ads, so we charge all advertisers for all readers. Let me say that again. All readers see all ads, so we charge all advertisers for all readers. That means that all readers were equally valuable. You didn't want to lose any reader because you could charge every advertiser for every reader. Right. And that's the economic basis that leads us from reach and frequency to page views and unique users. We are just transposing an old mass media model into a new world. And what it means is it's a world that's about messaging. We want to tell you something, whether you want to hear it or not, whether that's the news or whether that's a marketing message. And that doesn't work. It just simply doesn't work anymore because people don't want our messages. They can tune out our messages. They've got plenty of other choices of what to do with their time and attention. And so an organization like the Times is indeed valuable, but it gives us the same 300 to 500 pieces of content, the same to all of us, pretty much. Yes, it has regional variations and other things, but it doesn't really learn about me as a person. As a person, I'm neither a real man nor a real American. I don't know anything about sports. I always threw out the sports section. As a person, I'm a wonky, boring bozo who reads the media news. So why doesn't the Times throw out the sports and emphasize media? Just take the content they already have and reprioritize it based on knowing something about me. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm going to get into an echo chamber. It doesn't mean that I'm going to miss out on the important stories that happen. I'll still see the stories about Syria that don't fit into either of those buckets. Fine. But start to know me as an individual and treat me as an individual rather than as a member of the mass. But we're not there. So this idea that we have to get people to come to our website, I think is outmoded. I work with something called repost.us that makes articles embeddable like YouTube videos. Why shouldn't articles travel around the web like YouTube videos? And pardon me here, stay right there. sorry. No sneeze button.
You're allergic
on my
to this conversation.
So why don't we let our content go to the readers rather than always making our readers come to the content? Why don't we rethink the very form of what we do in the news? And why is it always necessarily an article? It doesn't have to be, right? Look at Vox and Wikipedia. They've unbundled the article and put background and explainers over here as a separate thing. And Twitter puts what's new up here. And we unbundle the publication. Now we're unbundling the article. Now people formerly known as the audience, as Jay Rosen says, have plenty of places to go. And so I think part of the problem with the Times report is it's still in that old media model of saying, number one, we make content and we want more people to see what we make. No, we should be starting with, what does the public need us to do? Journalism is a precious resource. The public can share information on their own without us. We have to add journalistic value to that, confirming facts, debunking rumors, asking the questions that aren't asked of public officials and those in power, adding context, adding explanation, adding background, finding people to trust, and so on and so on. Those are a lot of journalistic tasks, but those aren't necessarily about just churning out more content like sausage.
Well, and content that they have, as you mentioned, is actually really good content that we can trust, right? But then there's this conversation, too, around advertising, and then there's the agency-created content that is another conversation. You know, Scott Monty is actually on a hold and waiting to join us. And I know you can't stay very long. Jeff, can you stay for a few more minutes?
I got to say hello to Scott and find out what's happening.
Welcome, Scott, to the show.
Scott, you're on Twitter. You can take the tie off.
Thanks. I just got home.
Wait, you're wearing a tie, not a bow tie?
It's been known to happen from time to time. Sorry to disappoint.
You never disappoint. Actually, you always have an element of surprise, even today.
I do my best.
So we're talking in depth, of course, about the New York Times, and you wrote a really thought-provoked post about this yourself, which was, I highly recommend that anyone who's interested read it, what brands can learn from Bombshell, which is all about the innovation report the New York Times came out with. And what drove you, Scott, first to write this?
Well, you know, it was interesting because, you know, the Times report, there was so much focus on Jill Abramson and her role. And I thought, you know what, the story is bigger than a single person. And it's bigger than this issue of gender equity. And the real story behind it was exactly what the Times, I'm trying to get my microphone out of the line here. I'm used to doing just audio podcasts, so I apologize.
It makes you look really story, professional, Scott. Don't worry.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks
for showing us all up there.
Hello, Uncle Jeff.
Hey there. As opposed to Brian, who has his you know, $4.99 earbud. Right? So it makes you look much more
right
professional,
down there,
Scott.
You're ghetto, Brian.
I'm in my closet, and that's Scott's good. Like in a professional studio that he has constructed in his home. So, yeah.
This is my studio. Anyway, I thought that there was more of a story here behind the business of what was going on at the New York Times and, you know, why there had been such a shakeup beyond just the gender stuff. What really was driving the decisions there? And this report that was leaked almost concurrently with the personnel announcement was just chock full of information, of insights. Quite frankly, I was impressed with exactly how honest the Times was with itself, with where it needed to do some introspection and where it needs to make some improvements. They spent 6 months interviewing people inside and outside the company, and they credited people like Janine and like Henry Blodgett just as much as they were crediting quotes from the inside. So I began to pull this apart, and as I read more and more of it, I just became intrigued with the story here. And it's a story that goes well beyond the Times. You know, as I mentioned in my post, these are lessons that any business that generates any kind of content can take away. It's a story of staffing. It's a story of promotion. It's a story of how we interact with readers. You know, Jeff was just talking about this mass marketing approach. It breaks my heart how many companies have taken social media and have simply used it as another mass marketing, mass advertising platform instead of using it for what it's good at in Amen. Terms of, you know, listening to what your customers want, using it, combining it with email and CRM to truly provide content that matters to them. We're turning a deaf ear to one of the most powerful tools in the history of communications. And I got to credit the Times for starting to turn the battleship in the right direction, or the aircraft carrier. They haven't done it completely yet, but full credit to them for pointing us all in the right direction.
Jeff, so that's a pretty big mouthful, and this is a huge report. I highly recommend everyone read it, besides reading Scott's, as he called it, the Cliff Notes of the report. But what do you say about that, Jeff? I mean, what Scott is saying to me is that, you know, it's, you know, they're at least analyzing themselves and they're trying to get better. Something that you teach yourself and your you know, student here, Brian, has learned how to do. But they're just now here. Is it too late? I asked this earlier. Is it too late for them?
No, I don't think it is. I think it could be too late for some newspapers that are bad and getting worse. But, you know, Jill Abramson also made it, I think, a stronger paper while she was there. And but I think here's what they have to do. And the report hints at this. What does it mean to be digital first? The problem with this is that there's still revenue coming in from print. And the reason is, no offense to those in marketing around me, but advertisers are dumb. They go with habit. They go with what they've always done. Nobody ever gets fired by in the New York Times, right? And even though the audience is bigger online, even though the audience for prime time is sinking and so on, the advertisers are paying the bills and they're supporting the legacy. What you have to start doing is pushing your audience, your staff, and your advertisers all to the future. And the goal is pretty straightforward. The goal is to become a fully sustainable digital enterprise before print becomes unsustainable. Print will become unsustainable economically. So you've got to become a fully sustainable digital enterprise. And to get there, you can't just wait until that day happens and say, oh, well, now we're losing a fortune on the print. Well, gosh, what are we going to do? No, you've got to be way ahead of this. And so I think what it means is that the print product has to become your byproduct, your primary product. And the Times report says this, and the Guardian also believes this, and Digital First lives by this, is that your digital product, your digital service is primarily what you do. And print is something that you take and freeze dry stuff off of digital and put it into that ancient mode, as long as people and especially advertisers still want to subsidize it. And you've got to push your advertisers over to digital because that's where they want to be. Yes, of course, there's abundance. Yes, you don't control the scarcity the way you used to. You have to find new things to sell them beyond just reach and frequency. And no, you shouldn't sell them the family jewels by doing native advertising that tries to fool readers into what you were doing. You've got to bring all kinds of new skills to this. And people like Brian and Scott know a lot more about this than I do. But then you've got to figure out what the sustainable digital enterprise is. And it's going to be smaller. It's not going to be the big old monopoly you used to have. It's going to shrink in staff. You've got to prioritize to what really matters. You can't do the same stuff everybody else does and rewrite the same stories everybody else used to write. News is far more efficient because you can do what you do best and link to the rest. But you've got to make print yesterday, and you have to make digital today.
What would you say about that, Brian? I mean, you and I have had this conversation for many years, and, you know, I know you're a big fan of Jeff, but is he right on target? I mean, what do you say about, you know, digital agencies creating content? I mean, is that the new future?
Yeah, no. I mean, I've been talking about that for years and years, where I think every organization is and should think and act like a media company. The thing that's, you know, striking to me about the Innovation Report and the New York Times is how much of what, to me, and I think probably to Jeff and to Scott, seem like basic concepts of disruption and and listening to the audience, that how much of that needed to really be explained in the report. So, you know, my fear for an organization like the New York Times, which is already in the media business, which is already good at producing content that we know has value to audiences, but doesn't necessarily push it out or deliver it or create engagement around it in ways that are going to keep people around and drive people deeper. My fear, my concern is that, you know, organizations will mistake what is valuable in terms of content or valuable in terms of delivering a product back to that audience when they say they need something. And, you know, that everyone will become BuzzFeed or whatever, because they think that that is the quickest way to get that advertising revenue. There's still tremendous value to an institution like the New York Times going deep and doing investigative reporting, or even just doing the thoughtful analysis of local issues and, you know, finding a way to present it differently and engage and look at the audience differently, does not change that fact. So, I mean, I would put the question back to Jeff and Scott, because you come at it from different perspectives. You know, Scott, to me, it seems like one of the things that you've been able to do at Ford up until now from a social standpoint is because Ford has a good product, or has at various times had a good product. And so you could push an Alan Mulally out there. You could push different vehicles out there that people were curious about and wanted to engage with. And it gave you the freedom to experiment across the different platforms. You know, same, Jeff, you were, you know, gently ribbing sort of the BuzzFeeds of the world. You know, some of their content is good, but yeah, we don't need 22,000 cat posts to become the
Wait
center of.
I actually like.
I'm not dissing cat. I'm not a cat guy, but I'm just saying someone said today that in the last several years, 22,000 cat posts. You know, that is not what the audience.
That's it.
I know. What?
I my sense is that is not what the audience wants. If given the alternative to find something that is substantive and relevant to their lives or a, you know,
this
news
cat
product
post will change your life. You won't believe what happens next with this cat.
Thanks.
Welcome to BuzzFeed.
Hey, that's upworthy. Don't confuse them with BuzzFeed.
I know. Yeah. Welcome to BuzzFeed.
But, you know, it strikes me that we're at this risk of an organization like the New York Times mistaking that they, in fact, still do something that's valuable in favor of doing something quick and sexy and interactive. And, well, you know, I feel like you got to have both.
Yeah, and I would agree with that, Brian. But I don't think that the Times is necessarily throwing the baby out with the bathwater with regard to its content. Very clearly in there, they said their journalistic integrity will remain. And I think the core of what they offer is content. And, you know, Henry Blodgett, who was quoted in there, pointed out, you know, you have unlicensed access to one of the greatest archives of content of all time. And the fact that they actually, in the report, pulled out the fact that Gawker ended up scooping them on some of their own content on Oscar night, the Times ran the original story of 12 Years a Slave before it was even a novel, back when it was actually happening in the 1800s. And they didn't know that. And they weren't able to package that up in a way to get it in front of people in the right way, at the right time, on the right platform, because they aren't thinking digital first. And so maybe you take a few cues from BuzzFeed or The Guardian, places that have their editors and reporters actually promoting their own content. That you've got people who are in charge of content who can, at the drop of a hat, understand where they need to go to find this material and pull it forward to get it in front of the right people.
And that's exactly what Jeff was talking about, Scott. I mean, Scott, before you joined us, because you were writing a really important blog post that we're going to get to in a minute. Dun, dun, dun.
I just tweeted it. Wow, big news.
Thanks. carry on with your commentary there, Tony. I don't want to interrupt your train of thought.
You're our hero, Scott. No, but I mean, Jeff was just saying that. It's this idea that as content providers, as journalists, finding out what it is that, whether it's cat videos or something more important, like what's happening in the world, but finding out your personal interests and then catering content that's yours. I mean, we don't see that happening, certainly, from a platform standpoint. I mean, Facebook still doesn't know really what I want to see, and I get the wrong information or the wrong content all the time. So where does
Here's an interesting thing, though. I don't know how many consumers actually take the time to refine their Facebook feed. And maybe it's too hard. But every time you click on an ad, every time you like something, that tells Facebook something. And you can tell Facebook the negative, you know, the stuff that you don't like as well. And for me, I'm too busy to go through and actually take that time and click on every piece of content, whether I like it or not, and give them a message back. And frankly, I don't think most consumers know that either. So until the platform gets smarter or perhaps gets simpler to use, you know, Facebook and all of its privacy policies and everything all along has been very complex for the average user to understand. And I think we need to think more of the centrality of your average user, what's easiest for them and what can get them the content that's relevant to them.
So, Jeff,
let me ask you both a question. I'm going to Google tomorrow. That's why I have to be on an early flight, so I'll be leaving shortly, to talk to the privacy group there. And I want to talk to them about what I think they should be doing in terms of the best practices of privacy around just that. And with the knowledge that there is value back in sharing about yourself because you get greater value and greater relevance. Any suggestions for me about what you think the best practices of, you know, kind of radical privacy to protect sharing and the value of it would be?
Well,
go ahead, Brian.
I was going to say I don't know that I have a fancy answer or a you know, formula driven algorithmic powered solution, but I actually think that one of the big things missing in the whole privacy conversation is just fundamental customer service. Scott made the point, and I agree that, you know, the platforms need to get smarter, but it's too difficult. People don't know, they don't understand. There's confusion. So, you know, one of the things that Google with its wealth of resources could do is put some smart humans out there that would help everybody to refine their privacy settings and create the experience that they want. You can't program your way to a perfect human experience as much as, you know, I'm sure the engineers would like to say so. So I would encourage them to balance whatever they do on the algorithmic, formulaic, you know, ones and zeros side of this with some real human interaction, and not the kind that you know sort of outsource for the sake of getting off the phone quickly, but the kind that actually helps people to understand and deepen the positive experience around all of it.
Great point.
You know, Jeff, I think Silicon Valley and primarily Google and Facebook, but I mean, you can extrapolate to any number of companies, has a communications problem. They do not get out front of their products and of their changes to their products to tell the story. They wait for users to tell the story for them. And because of that, we've seen such fragmentation of messaging and such disparate opinions. And I think Google's a little better at this in terms of its explanatory videos than Facebook. But by and large, they push an update and then they wait for the reaction, and they either retract what the update is and then eventually creep back up without you noticing, which I think is dishonest and inherently bad for business, or they simply turn a deaf ear to it and they say, well, this is the product decision, we're going with it anyway. And I think the degree to which they can educate, inform, and bring along the user base without dumping something on them is incredibly important.
I think Google has a huge opportunity. I think if anybody can do this, they can, and they know so much about us. And I think this it could absolutely be where, I mean, Facebook has, they had the opportunity, and they have made it actually more challenging, I think, for the average consumer, to your point, Scott, to actually change their settings or to understand what that means. And maybe they're just kind of lazy, so they don't want to figure it out. But I think there's a huge opportunity here. Jeff, since you're the non-marketer here, who should really be creating the content? I think, you know, we see agencies becoming content creators. Are they going to wipe out the traditional media journalist, or is it a fair fight?
No, my issue with the trend in native advertising issues are a few. One is, this is not the latest thing that's going to just save us, just as paywalls didn't save us and tablets didn't save us. My real problem is that too much of native advertising tries to fool the reader. Too much of brand-created content within media tries to fool the reader into thinking that it doesn't have a message and a viewpoint from a commercial interest. And, you know, it is possible to do it well. If you look at, let's say, Flipboard and pardon me, Scott, for a different car company, but won't matter to you as much anymore now. Mini has, it's on his blog, it's okay. Mini has, you know, created magazines on Flipboard where they, you know, have a community, people get together to meet up and so on. I think that brands that create content that are obviously and clearly of and from the brands is fine. My problem is when they try to fool the reader into thinking it's not. You know, if you look at Forbes and it says brand voice, and then there's a link to it saying, what's this? If you have to have that link saying, what's this, then you're probably obviously not clear enough as to what it is. It's called advertising. And we should say that. I also think, I argue to marketers and PR people that it's foolish for them to come after the content business, because let me tell you, content's a crappy business. Let me tell you, I'm in the content business. It's not a good business. You don't want to do that. So I think that brands can indeed have direct, open, honest, valued, substantive relationships with people using content as one of the tools to do that. I think brands, more importantly, can move their customers up the chain into design and product selection and give customers a lot more power. And that's a hallmark of a collaborative relationship. Just as media should have a collaborative relationship with the public, so should brands, even car companies. But I think that to try to fool people into thinking that this content is real is not going to go anywhere. And indeed, Chartbeat has found that when people go to legitimate, call it, content, they scroll 75% of the time. That's to say they engage 75% of the time, approximately. When they go to native advertising, they only do so 25% of the time, which is to say that the public isn't fooled. They know junk when they see it. They don't want to get messages. So I think that if you're a car company, for example, then you have things to say not about flowers and sunshine and bells and whistles. You have things to say about cars. And I want to know about that stuff. And I want to know how the electric car works. And I want to have a relationship with you on that content. And that's great. Don't try to fool me. Don't try to trick me. Don't think that you need to be in the content business. You're not. You're in the relationship business, just as media should be.
Good point. I know you. I'd love to have you stay. But I know you need to get out. And so it was a good note. You've got a pretty early flight in the morning, and you've graciously given us your time. And I appreciate you coming on. So especially because I know you wanted to.
And now you can all get a word in edgewise, which would be far better. You can listen to real marketers about what matters about marketing.
Well, and I know that you wanted to talk to Scott before you checked out.
So Scott, are you going to say anything? Since you got your blog post up, I think this is important.
I think my blog post says it all. I've left Ford Motor Company. After 6 years, I'm driving off into the sunset.
Of great work.
Thank you very much. It's been a tremendous, tremendous ride for me personally and professionally. I think Ford Motor Company has come an amazing distance over these last 6 years, certainly under the leadership of Alan Mulally, with all of the great people that we have on the marketing team and the communications team. This is clearly a team effort. And while I get a lot of credit for being the front person for it, believe me, there are many, many good people behind all of the great work that Ford Motor Company does.
Well, Scott, I can't wait to hear what's next. You're being coy in your blog post, so I expect you to
stay tuned. The focus today is on what we've been able to accomplish at Ford and all the great things there. I'll have a separate announcement about the other good news fairly soon.
What I want to know, Jeff, and I think you need to be here for this, is, Scott, are you joining the New York Times?
haven't received the call yet, but after that blog post, who knows?
I have not gotten a tattoo yet. So.
You've got us all. We have like an office pool thing happening, Scott. We're all like really curious where you're going.
Interesting. You'll probably all lose. And I don't have a Ford tattoo that I have to get lasered off, so don't worry.
That's probably good.
That's good.
Well, best of luck, Scott.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Good to see you again.
I'll follow the next chapter eagerly.
Many thanks.
Thanks for joining us, Jeff. And we'll look forward to this week in Google. Have a safe flight.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
Cheers all.
Such an honor to have Jeff join us. I didn't know, Brian, that you actually studied under Jeff until this pre-show, but that was interesting. It makes a lot of sense.
I did know. I used to interview on your show from the sound booth at the entrepreneurial program at CUNY. So right down the hall from Jeff's office. Yeah.
Wow. Very cool.
I know, small world. So, so Scott, I mean, you definitely are the agency, you know, brand side of creating content. You've worked with a lot of agencies. Brian, you've been on both the agency side, now even your own agency. So where should, you know, I asked this question to Jeff, but I want you guys to say, where should content be created? Because we are seeing a big shift. And is it trusted content when an agency creates it? And how, as a consumer, are we digesting the difference between agency-created content and traditional journalism?
It doesn't matter, as far as I'm concerned. And the other debate is, oh, great, you bring it in-house. Well, does the communications team take responsibility for it, or does the marketing team take responsibility for it? As long as you're using data and you understand what your audience wants, it doesn't matter. Because you know what? To the consumer, to them, it's just the brand. They don't know if it's an agency. They don't know if it's marketing. They don't know if it's communications. It doesn't matter. As long as it's the most relevant content that speaks to that audience and helps move the relationship along, you know, whether you're trying to make sales or create impressions or whatever your objective is, if you can measure your success based on the content, it doesn't matter where it comes from.
You made a lot of really interesting points in your post about the New York Times Innovation Report, which was leaked, but we all have it. So I don't know. Do you think it was purposely leaked, or do you think it was accidentally leaked? I mean, they've been in the news enough.
Yeah, no, I think somebody in the newsroom leaked it intentionally, but not with this kind of publication, because the version I have, and I printed it out so I could really thumb through it, is this over photocopied PDF, and
they released the new one on my blog.
Exactly. Once they knew it was out, they're like, well, we may as well have the good copy out there to have everybody see the color version. So I think this was sneaked out under cover of darkness and leaked intentionally. But, you know, now we've got the actual one out there.
So what was your biggest takeaway from this? I mean, I mentioned Cliff Notes, but quite candidly, even your post was quite the read. And I recommend anybody that follows you go to your Facebook page. You've posted it there on your blog. You've got it on your, you know, you've tweeted about it. What was your biggest takeaway from this entire innovation report? I mean, is it too late for them? Is it, you know, like you said, is it they're being really thoughtful about what they need to do? Or is it that they're still a little clueless in some areas? Because I would say I asked a lot of people their opinions on this, and there were a lot of people that felt like they didn't necessarily agree with you and that they felt like this was not the way that they should approach creating content.
Well, look, I mean, the New York Times probably knows what's best for it, being the closest to their business and closer than any of us are. And they spent a good 6 months. They asked the right questions. I think they delved into things like audience development and working on discovery, promotion and connection, which you could argue they really didn't pay much attention to before. They figured if we build it, they will come. And Janine Gibson very clearly said that's not the case anymore. And that was a big wake-up call to a lot of people. I think the fact that they started thinking about the newsroom in conjunction with the business side, not continuing to separate the two, but really understanding how the two play together. That, to me, is extraordinarily important. Getting editors involved in the architecture of sites and apps and things like that. Getting designers and developers involved in what's happening on the newsroom front. You know, there's been this wall that's gone off between the two that has really separated them out, and that's hurt them strategically.
So Scott Monty or Brian Rich, who would you say is leading right now? Is it the brand or is it traditional journalism? Who, you know, like, I've actually had Jeff Cutler come on, who does a lot of training for journalists and how to be better at, you know, digital. And he does a great job of that. And it's still something that I think journalists are trying to figure out. The younger journalists have a much better handle on how to get their content out there. But obviously, marketing agencies get it much better. So who's leading? Mm-hmm. Who's winning?
So a couple things. One, I would separate journalists from media. I think there are certainly some journalists who get it and are producing extraordinary, you know, coverage of issues and, you know, whatever's happening in the world and pushing it out across a variety of platforms in a very compelling way. And, you know, all of the best companies, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, Vox, 538, et cetera, you know, they all have their moments, but they also are, you know, full of just missed opportunities and sort of really poor efforts. And I think for the most part, you know, and I'm generally kind of a down on agency type of person. I don't actually think that agencies really understand it. They may understand a lot of the bells and whistles and the new platforms, but for the most part, when you look at true engagement, when you look at the quality of the experience, when you look at the ability to drive actual behaviors, actual purchase, there are very few companies, if any, that consistently have figured that stuff out. I think the, you know, Tanya, you and I talk about this all the time, and Scott, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. I think the, you know, the most sophisticated media technology producers, those who create the greatest content and experience combined, are the industry. But I also think that they have an incredible advantage, which is they have live, you know, real time, you don't know the ending, suspenseful events. It's a very different challenge to sell a car when, after you kick the tires that one time, you know what you're going to get. And if it resonated, great. And if it didn't, you may not have the right consumer there. But, you know, game one and game two of a series can be entirely different stories unto themselves. And, you know, as you know, anything unfolds throughout a season, you're going to see the nature of that story change and the opportunities to engage different people, fans of different levels and types, differently. So I think the people who are doing the most sophisticated stuff and who really get it are the ones who are having to deal with all of this stuff in real time, which right now may really be limited to the sports industry.
It's interesting.
Comment, Scott?
You know, it's for the auto industry in particular, it's challenging because it is a very complex process. And when you consider that the car is the second most expensive single item that you will purchase in your life for most people, obviously a lot of research goes into that. And there's a very complex arrangement as to how people actually get their information. And frankly, I think too many companies, too many auto companies spend way too much time on trying to capture the sale and not enough on the service afterwards. You know, if you look at the average length of ownership over the last decade, people have owned cars for 10, 11, 12 years. And that's longer than before the recession. So what are we doing to actually treat customers well along that entire customer life cycle, along that entire customer journey, not just about when they're ready to buy a car? And so it's a very complex arrangement. And I think, Brian, your point that sports, because they have to watch what happens in real time, because they don't know how things turn out, it's a great analogy. Now, it's not as quick in the auto industry because you're talking about months and maybe even years in some cases, but I think it's absolutely critical that we have to follow along because you don't know where the life cycle of your customer is going after they've bought the car. Will they get in a wreck? Will they break down? Will they need new aftermarket parts or what have you? Who knows? But it's the fun of the journey along the way and listening for those cues and being able to step in and provide value to people as appropriate that we really need to concentrate on.
Okay, so let's talk about where you guys are not quite there, but I think you're talking about different types of content and the different types of content that's created. So you have, you know, content that's created about, you know, the best food for your kids and what's really healthy choices and maybe something along those lines. Or you might have some really serious political conversation. And then we have advertising. And where does the advertising fold in? Is it where does the advertising get placed in the content and that sort of thing? That's another conversation of where marketing meets journalism. And if I'm reading something that's really thought-provoking and isn't necessarily something I would pin on Pinterest, I may not want a lot of advertising. But if I'm reading something kind of light, like a BuzzFeed kind of content, then advertising, I think, is better, certainly more digestible, so to speak. So what are your thoughts on that, Scott? I mean, where should advertising fit in?
It's a tough question because in some ways we always look to advertising to kind of support the mechanisms that we choose to communicate on. And yet people don't like being advertised to. It's simple as that, especially where they're having relationship-based conversations. And I think that's why it's funny. There was a list that was compiled recently of the top 40 social salespeople. And I got honorable mention there. And I said, well, I don't sell, right? But people have told me over time, it doesn't ever feel like I'm selling because I'm taking part in a conversation and I'm imparting knowledge or sharing information about Ford's products or what have you as part of that conversation. And it doesn't feel like an interruption. It just feels like a natural flow of conversation. If we can get to the point where advertisers are part of the conversation. There was actually a great cartoon today that Tom Fishburne posted. I don't know if you know Tom Fishburne. He calls himself the marketoonist. He posted people sitting around a table saying, "What, you know, here are my cat photos. Here's where I went on vacation." And then there's a Subway sub saying, "Our sandwiches have 7 less grams of fat than our competitors." And it's like, what are you doing? You know, we're having a conversation over here and you're bombarding us with inane commentary that's completely unrelated to what we want to hear. And I think if we can fine tune our content and the stories we tell around that content so that it's more human and that we actually have human beings taking part of this in this stuff, it's going to make a huge difference.
What would you say about that, Brian? I mean, you're a fan of everything, you know, whether it's entertainment or I know I can always count on Brian to contribute, whether the show's about entertainment, whether it's a reality show like Real Housewives. Yeah, I can ask Brian about that. Or
and cars. I agree with Scott. I think we have to move much more towards developing a relationship and having a relevant conversation between brands and the audience they're trying to reach, whether they are consumers ready to purchase or potentially future consumers who are going to, you know, have their whole perception of a brand shaped early on and the possibility of, you know, becoming a buyer of something, you know, sort of set in motion, you know, only to be realized later. At the same time, one of the things that I would say, which I think is important, is just in asking your question, Tanya, you took what I would say is a very narrow definition of advertising. And I think this is one of the things that the media world has struggled with. And you saw this in the Innovation Report, and you see it in a lot of marketing that is ad agency driven in particular, which is, you know, display ads or text ads are not the only ways, nor I would argue even the most valuable ways to monetize the relationship between a brand and a consumer. Memberships and subscription and you know, things that can be calibrated more towards the amount of time someone spends or the value that they receive from the connection with a brand. There are, you know, a multitude of ways that you can get somebody to part with their dollars if that is ultimately, you know, the metric of success that a brand is going to use. And pushing display advertising, you know, or any other kind of, you know, interruption sort of based advertising, to me is sort of an agency driven laziness. It's this idea that, you know, we can pat ourselves on the back because we got X number of impressions in front of somebody, or we are able to push our message out there, when, you know, the actual end transaction, that end connection, you know, is something that's much more intimate and very rarely triggered by, you know, that initial ad. I'm not saying that ads don't have value in the sort of sales process, but it's very, very early on and very much at the sort of top of the funnel, if you will. What we have to look at, I think, are more ways to create those relationships and monetize them through, you know, different definitions of value, whether it's, you know, time spent or you know, amount of a product utilized, or, you know, even just what we see a lot now with things like Kickstarter and Indiegogo, where, you know, you can almost define the value that you place on something, or you can be incentivized to, you know, part with your dollars in a way that is not, you know, just directly product transactional. I just think there's a lot more sort of monetization strategy that we haven't really dug into in really significant and compelling ways.
And, you know, this is being mentioned in the chat room kind of over and over again, and they're kind of hyped up too about this idea of advertising to, you know, content that isn't really appropriate. And I think we're all trying to figure this out. What would you say to the piece, Scott, where we're looking at impressions and how do we measure? I mean, how did you measure this at Ford? I mean, is it really the impressions, which I don't think it is, but certainly that was even mentioned in the New York Times article.
Well, look, it depends on what you're trying to achieve. For the purposes of a new vehicle reveal, it's just about awareness. For the sake of a vehicle launch, it's more about how you're driving people to the dealership. There's any number of ways to measure this stuff. And frankly, we haven't figured it out yet. And I think the industry is still grappling with that. Why? Because we put a traditional lens against new media or against new ways of reaching people. And I think we have to throw out some of the traditional ways of thinking and come up with brand new metrics that make sense. I don't pretend to have it all figured out yet. There are much brighter minds than mine, specifically in the analytics space, that, you know, make this their living. But I know we together as an industry need to work on this. The ANA just announced that they're going to be taking the lead in some of this. I know Katie Payne, from a PR measurement standpoint, in the digital space, has been taking a leadership role in redefining what the standards are for the communications industry. So I think it's early days yet, but it has to be more than likes, tweets, shares, impressions. You know, we have to go well beyond just this scratching of the surface.
Well, and I think as technology advances, I think, you know, Jeff, I think Google, there's huge opportunity that Google has not capitalized on when it comes to taking intel about customers and really servicing us with the kind of content we care about. I mean, I don't think I'd mind advertising so much if I felt like it was more appropriate to me and something I was interested in versus maybe a sofa that I searched for a year ago and I don't need anymore. I get constantly served, you know, contextual targeting that doesn't really approach. But, you know, Google knows what I want. It knows where I'm at. And I think there's a huge opportunity where we have developed relationships with companies like Google or even Facebook, who I think, you know, Facebook is going to miss the boat if they don't really change the way that they approach dealing with customers. What would you say about that, Brian?
Oh, no, I think there is a ton of room still, particularly for folks like Google, to be explored in terms of, you know, aligning with what customers or audiences have in terms of their expectations, in terms of the information that they want. I actually think that part of the reason that the New York Times Innovation Report is so important, and Scott hit on this in his blog post and some others have touched on it as well, but part of the reason that it is such an important read is because it's really just the story of everybody looking to connect with an audience around something that's happening in the world today that's relevant in their lives. The difference is that's the business that the New York Times is in. That's the business that the world of media is in. The product companies and the brands and the Googles of the world, they see themselves, I think, far too often as, in the case of Google, a technology company, a facilitator for some aspect of life. But from a consumer standpoint, from the user standpoint, you know, Google is just as much a part of everything I do today as anything else. It's not a company to me. It's the place I go to get, you know, the phone number for the restaurant I want to call or the directions or that document I saved, right? It's part of just the step-by-step facilitation of my survival in many respects. And I think that's the way people see a lot of the brands that they have. Car, you know, a car for someone is not just the second most expensive purchase in their life. It's how they get to and from work. It's how they bring their child home from the hospital. It's, you know, how they go and, you know, go out on a date or have fun or whatever it is. It's, you know, part of their, you know, sort of choice in how they want to live their life. And obviously the vehicle that they choose, you know, there are lots of factors in that as a result. So I just think, yeah, there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of intelligence that would, you know, that I think exists, by the way, and I think Google has in a database somewhere that they're just not using. They're not being smart about it and not giving credit to the consumer that, yeah, if you serve better advertising to them, you'd probably get greater loyalty and, you know, deeper connection and probably more money spent on whatever it is you're trying to push.
So, Scott, you've got such a background of expertise, and we're all big fans of yours and what you've done at Ford. And, of course, we're all really excited about learning what your next big move is. We're going to be watching you and watching your posts to see what happens. And I tell you, we have an office pool. I'm sure I'm going to be the wig winner. I'm putting lots of little, you know, guesses down. I don't know, Brian. Brian thinks he's going to win, but he's not.
I think Scott's going to become like his own hologram or something like that. I don't think any existing institution or company or brand, you know, is innovative and can contain Scott Monty. So I think he's just going to have to be sort of the thing.
Who says I'm not already a hologram?
Hey, I'm just saying. I heard somebody saw you like six blocks away about 30 seconds ago. So it's entirely possible that
holograms.
You and Michael Jackson up there on stage at the, Tonys in a couple of weeks.
And Scott definitely is his own brand. Did you guys watch the billboards? By the way, I mean, I know it's not the Grammys, but no. Come on,
it's kind of like staring into the sun. But yes, I did watch.
I really liked the whole Michael Jackson thing. It was kind of,
it was pretty fast. I will say this, Scott, if you do get into the hologram business, that was pretty cool. So, you know, Michael Jackson almost looked realistic. I mean, realizing that he presumably has not been alive for many years now. He was more lifelike than several of the actors or musicians on stage. I'll just say it that way.
The last time I gave a public speech, people said I almost looked like lifelike too. So, I mean, good.
We'll
company,
take compliments wherever we can get them. I know that feeling.
I know.
So I believe one of my guesses is, and don't reveal it, Scott, whatever you do, but I one of my guesses is that you're going to go work for the Muppets. And
the Muppets.
No?
Interesting. Interesting. Could be. Waka waka.
I would be so supremely jealous were you to go work for the Muppets. I don't know what I would do.
I'd rather go work for the Simpsons, quite frankly.
Really?
What kind of pathetic truck do you take me for?
That was really well done.
He's kind of impressive, right, Brian? I'm kind of impressed. So, what's your favorite voice, Scott? I have to ask.
My favorite voice?
Uh-huh.
Jeez, I don't know. I guess it would be Barney. That's a good one. You know?
Well?
Which I just did.
Oh. He's like, I just
Barney,
did it.
Don't steal any beer while I'm gone. What kind of pathetic drunk do you take me for? Someone spilled beer in this ashtray.
Can you do Gonzo? Somebody's asking for Gonzo.
Gonzo? No, Gonzo's not really a good voice.
Sorry. I asked, Bacon.
You
know,
I'm really a Muppet voice guy. What can I say?
My first guess. So was it Sesame Street? I thought you were more Muppets.
I said Simpsons.
I'm a Sesame Street guy. Sesame Street,
Muppets. I mean, they're all good. They're all entertaining. Good, wholesome family fun, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. He's going to Pixar.
Don't. I was going to take that
change
one.
Change my bet.
There's going to be a whole pool. I'm going to make it like go viral on the internet. Everybody's going to want to know where he's going, what the big guess is. So we'll be watching.
Whatever you collect, I want a 10% cut.
10%? Who says you're not a sales guy?
I haven't gotten a single dime of commission for every Ford car I've sold over the last 6 years. So it's the least you could do for me.
You know what? You're probably one of the people that I think has most built a personal brand. And I've often wanted to talk about this on the show. And in the past, we've certainly talked about it. What would your advice be to someone who is interested in creating their own personal brand?
You know, I never set out to create a personal brand. I'm myself. And I was before I came to Ford. It's one of the reasons they hired me. I continue to do that. I talk to people. I listen to what's going on. I derive great joy in learning about other people. And I talk about the things that interest me. And for whatever ungodly reason, people have found that equally as interesting. So I don't really make it a point to set out and create a personal brand. I just am who I am.
I am what I am, he says.
Yeah, the Popeye approach to social media, I guess,
Popeye.
Right?
Do Popeye. I like this. I could just do this all night.
This is horrible. People did not tune in for this.
This is great content. Who are we kidding?
Oh, okay. No kidding. Tonight on the Tonight Show.
Oh, my favorite. Do you know I bought on, I'm going to confess, I actually buy some things on eBay from time to time. And I actually bought some Johnny Carson memorabilia. The cover of Rolling Stone with Johnny Carson and David Letterman, which now.
Wow.
I know.
That's impressive. One of my favorite new podcasts is the Carson podcast with Mark Malkoff. Mark's a comedian. And he's just gotten this really enterprising view because he loves Johnny Carson and the Carson Show. And he just goes around finding people that were influenced by the show or who were on it or who worked for Johnny. And he puts it out weekly. Check it out. It's carsonpodcast.com.
I'm familiar with that. I need to listen to it. That was my first crush, I think, was on Johnny Carson as a little girl. Oh, my God. Aww. That dates me. I know.
Cliff's Notes, Johnny Carson. What are you, from the 70s?
No, maybe. Brian, what's on your radar? We know Scott's looking for this. Scott's got something big. And again, there's the whole big pool thing that we're going to be continuing to try to speculate what's his next big move. What are you looking at? What's on your radar?
Well, I'm going to go to sports because why not? The NHL playoffs are on. The NBA playoffs are on. And, you know, look, there's nothing better than playoff hockey, the hitting, and then at the end of the series they line up and they shake hands and in most cases show extraordinary sportsmanship. It's just wonderful. But looking way ahead, we're only about 3 weeks from the beginning of the World Cup, and when soccer descends on the world and everybody remembers that they're a huge fan of one of the great sports on the planet. So I am already obsessed, and we are still about 3.5 weeks out from the June 12th beginning of the World Cup.
And you and I are planning some really mischievous content creation around the World Cup, I'm excited to say. Leo's a big fan, I think, of the World Cup, so I'll have to make sure we get his point of view on that. Are you
excited? I will paint my face, perhaps, for that.
I should do that, too.
I think we all should. We should just pick our country of choice. Do you have a team, Scott, that you would paint your face,
Scott,
a flag or something?
No.
No.
I share my enthusiasm internally.
Internally?
Yeah, I don't.
That could be painful. I would be careful with that.
Yeah, no. I keep it inside. Don't worry.
I don't even know where to go with that one. Thank you so much, guys, for joining us on the show and talking about this evolution of journalism and media content creation and what's happening at the New York Times, which has been all over the news. I think, again, if somebody wants to check out your blog and the content you've created, Scott, and follow you until the big news is revealed. It's time to place your bets, everybody, because you know once the betting is closed, the betting is closed. How can we follow you, Scott?
I'm Scott Monty everywhere on Twitter, scottmonty.com, on Facebook, LinkedIn. But LinkedIn, I really keep just for people I've met or that I've interacted with. So. No funny business there. See me on Twitter and Facebook.
No funny business? Well, yeah. With you, it's always funny business. So.
Yeah. And if you want to check out my voiceover demo reel, it's on my site at scottmonty.com. 28 Simpsons voices in less than a minute and 10 seconds.
That's so awesome. This is, you're revealing where you're going to go. And I think we know.
You'll see.
And Brian, if we want to check out your work, your book, you've got another one in the works, right? Or do you?
Always. Well, I mean, some short ones, some ebooks and things. So, yeah.
How can we follow
but you can,
you?
My Twitter is my name, BRIANRECH. I'm otherwise highly Googleable. And if you search really well, you can probably find some pictures of me with some of my favorite Muppets. No voices, but some photographic evidence. Gonzo often travels with me on business trips. So,
really?
Yeah. No, my daughter Lucy likes it when Gonzo travels with me, and actually got me a Gonzo that was sort of a doppelganger to me.
If you had to pick one character that would be you, you would pick Gonzo?
Well, yeah. I mean, Gonzo in a sweater vest and a tie is pretty much sort of my personality in a nutshell, I think.
who are you, Scott? What Sesame Street character are you, or Muppet?
Oh, geez. Probably Fozzie Bear.
You're Fozzie?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, constantly telling stupid jokes that don't go over well. Maybe they do. I don't know.
I think they do. I think you're a pretty funny guy. I don't know who I would be.
Beaker.
I'm Beaker?
Ooh, Beaker's a good one.
No, no, no. I was going to say Beaker as a backup. But you, Tony, you'd be...
Oscar?
Animal.
Animal?
No.
I like Animal.
Really?
I would go out with Animal.
Oh, good one,
you
Rolf.
Go out with Animal.
I like Cookie Monster.
Cookie is my... I mean, I had a Cookie Monster. I have a Cookie Monster collection. And
really?
Cookie's my guy. We go way back, Cookie and I. But... But Gonzo, okay. I mean, you know.
You wrote a poem and you didn't know it.
Yeah. But, yeah, Gonzo and Cookie. So you can't go wrong with Cookie Monster. I mean, think about it, right? Anytime something goes wrong in the world, he just eats it.
It's true.
Just, like, doesn't let it bother him. He just destroys it.
I also like Oscar the Grouch, so I don't know what that says about me. And a bit of a crush on Count Dracula.
Ah, well, the Count, yes, of course.
Oh, the Count.
One lovely crush.
I'm a complicated girl. What can I say? Thanks again, you guys. I'm super excited to hear where you're going to go, Scott and Brian. I know you're working on a lot of things too. But that will conclude. Thank you guys. And I appreciate you joining the show.
Pleasure.
Anytime. Thank you.
That concludes this episode of Marketing Mavericks. And I appreciate everyone for tuning in. You can follow us on Twitter by going to hashtag Marketing Mavericks. You can also email me with your ideas or suggestions or whatever at mavericks@twit.tv or find me on Twitter at Tanya Hall Radio. I'd love to hear from you and find out what it is that you'd like to hear more about on Marketing Mavericks. Thanks, everybody.